McGabble Jones paced in front of the class. Jones, a bald man dressed in a suit and tie, moved with the posture and efficiency of a drill sergeant who had been drinking strong coffee since dawn, but he spoke with a preacher's flair. Though many of us had arrived at the Addison Radisson as amateurs, Jones assured us we had come a long way. By now, we could authoritatively deploy lingo like knockdown price and quantity options. We had learned about things one might find while auctioning off the contents of an abandoned storage unit, both the intriguing, a gun collection, and the unexpected, a Zamboni. We were close to grasping a basic chant, the hypnotic blur of words and numbers that builds to a crescendo as a sale is finalized. But that evening, Jones expected us to demonstrate our new skills in a live-streamed charity auction. The stakes, he reminded us, were very high. Hundreds of people on Facebook would be watching, and thousands of potential dollars to help the very sick children at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital and the Scottish Rite Hospital for Children were on the line. I feel so good today, Jones said, launching into what was intended to be a rousing pep talk. I don't know why I feel so good. He took a breath and looked to the wall as if it were a beautiful horizon. He returned his attention to the class, and his speech took a sudden, sobering turn. Imagine today was your last day. The room fell silent until one student, David Skidmore, a retired IT professional from Friendswood with rosy cheeks and white hair, piped up unprompted with a story he'd read about a singer-songwriter who stopped mid-performance, told the audience, "I'm sorry," and dropped dead. Raising an eyebrow and nodding, Jones continued, "Imagine today was your last day, your last week. I don't mean to be morbid." He paused for a moment of silence as we contemplated our mortality. Another student, John Montgomery, a Burleson building contractor and fifth-generation Texan with a booming Old Testament voice, announced that if today were his last day, he'd like to take the opportunity to eat some more of the donuts that our classmate Cliff Brewster had brought that morning. Others agreed. But before we raced to the donuts, Jones led the group in prayer, as he'd done to mark our other milestones. "May our chance be the best they can be," he began. "May they serve the Lord's purpose." He took a deep breath and stood straight and high-kneed back to his lecture chair, trumpeting with a smile, "I'm filled with the Holy Spirit." He took his seat, and Lori Jones, vice president of America's Auction Academy and a former spouse of Mike Jones, passed out half-inch thick packet titled Licensing and Regulation Auction Law. Each one landed in front of us with a solemn thunk. Sidebar here. It says, the big leagues. Heritage Auctions, headquartered in Dallas, is the third largest auction house in the world, selling art, memorabilia, and wines, among many, many other valuables. Here are some of their all-time biggest sales. A movie poster from the movie Dracula from 1931 featuring a heavily rouged Bela Lugosi sold for $525,000 in 2017. In November 2019, a copy of Marvel Comics No. 1, the granddaddy of all Marvels, became the most expensive Marvel comic ever sold, netting $1.26 million. Wayne Thiebaud's iconic painting Blueberry Custard sold for $3,255,000 in November 2019. In 1952, Topps Mickey Mantle baseball card in mint condition sold for $2,880,000 in 2018. Heritage calls it a most attractive form of portfolio diversification. And in 2014, a rare coin, the 1787 New York Brasher doubloon, sold for $4,582,500. Now, back to our text. Katie Bond reminds us, "I was not an obvious candidate for auctioneer school. I'm not a particularly fast talker. I'm not loud, and I'm loath to ask for money. But I've always been fascinated by the auctioneer's chant. Who among us hasn't been entranced by the rhythm, the energy, and the mystery of the auctioneer's incantations? As the daughter and granddaughter of voice teachers, I've witnessed many a student's metamorphosis from a squealing lamb into an operatic soprano, but I couldn't begin to imagine how one would teach a novice to chant like an auctioneer, speaking so dizzyingly fast that the words jangled in uninitiated ears like a foreign language. The technique seemed Talmudic, as cool as beatboxing and Tuvan throat singing. That, and it seemed like a good party trick. So I enrolled at America's Auction Academy, biggest auction school in Texas. A few minutes later, an email arrived containing a 62-page introductory practice guide, including an intimidating amount of number drills and tongue twisters. I clicked on an audio file and tried to follow along. I did all right at first, but grew overwhelmed within minutes, stumped by this one. Betty Botter bought some butter, but she said, "This butter's bitter. If I put it in my batter, it will make my batter bitter." So she bought a bit of better butter, put it in her bitter batter, made her bitter batter better. So 'tis better Betty Botter bought a bit of better butter. Any English proficiency I might have assumed of myself was suddenly insufficient. I was like a choreographer in a 40-yard dash. But I practiced every morning for 20 minutes in the weeks before the program began. By the time I packed my bags, I felt only minimal jaw cramping. When I arrived at the Addison Radisson at 8 a.m. on the first day of class, a sound system in the front of the room was blasting James Taylor's "You've Got a Friend." Students handed in any outstanding paperwork, and everyone took their seats at fold-out tables covered in black polyester tablecloths. A student named Lorraine Bice stopped by my table on her way to the front of the room, clutching her belongings to her chest like a high school freshman. She spoke with a disarmingly thick Dolly Parton drawl, and her sweet face was framed by a caramel-highlighted shag hairdo. She owned an antique store in Jefferson, she explained, and after she started hiring an auctioneer friend to host auctions, or she's decided to learn the business herself. "My feet don't usually hit the floor till 9 o'clock," she said, shaking her head with a woozy smile. "I didn't know 8 o'clock came twice a day." As the administrative scurry settled, Mike Jones marched to the front of the room. "Morning," he said, taking a seat in an elevated chair. Class's response was respectably audible, given the early hour, but Jones raised an eyebrow and hollered, "Morning! You've got to project." "What I'm trying to do is teach you everything I know in 8 days," he continued. Jones was a National Auctioneers Association Hall of Famer who started out dirt poor and decided to get rich, specializing in the sale of large ranches and the liquidation of industrial properties. "We wanted to get rich too," he assumed, "unless we were idiots." With that, he launched into the characteristics of the auctioneer chant we would be learning. Live bid calling is like a series of contracts, and when an auctioneer says sold, accepting the bid, the highest bidder is on the hook. Therefore, each part of the chant is crucial. A chant is made of three components: a statement, a question, and a suggestion, Jones began. The jumbles of syllables between the numbers are called filler words. The class scribbled. The basic chant Jones proposed, the one we would employ for the remainder of the class, and it would provide a soundtrack for all our dreams and nightmares, was $1 bid, now two, will you give me two? This chant was the Dick and Jane of the form, the starter set upon which we would build our own auctioneer identities. A chant is as much a trademark to an auctioneer as James Brown's scream and Bob Wills' high-pitched holler were to them. All chants, Jones stressed, must be conducive to rhythm, melody, and clarity, exploiting words that easily roll off the tongue. Filler words and phrases like "bid 'em at" and "gimme" and "I'm bid" and "how about" are better than "what about," since consonants that use the front of the mouth like B require less breath than letters like W. Jones asked us to hold our hands in front of our mouths to compare "who" to "gimme" to demonstrate how much more breath was required for the former. The numbers need to be clear. The filler words are there for pleasure, to add an energetic, pressing, hypnotic quality. Filler words should give buyers time to consider their next offers, but not so much time that the rhythm of the chant is broken. A clunky chant could lead to a hoarse auctioneer and confused or sluggish audience members reluctant to bid. "There is no book," Jones continued. "There's no company that says, this is how you do it. There is no professor except me, Professor Jones." Actually, America's Auction Academy has several auctioneer instructors and is one of a handful of well-regarded auctioneer schools in the United States. Jones founded the academy in the 90s, and it grew with Jones's business and reputation. He had started out doing consignment auctions in 1979, back when going to an auction was a national pastime. There were 3 TV channels, no malls, no computers. And there were people who didn't have any money but came anyway, he told me. It was like a fair. In 1981, Jones got his big break. He was hired to liquidate the contents of Western Auto Stores. Pretty soon, he was selling a Western Auto Store every week. They used to call me the Western Auto King, he said. Soon he was liquidating Montgomery Ward stores, True Value Hardware stores, and missile plants. In an economic downturn such as the one we're experiencing, auctioneers might find themselves busier than ever as businesses begin to waver and individuals begin unloading property. 2008, shortly after the Dow dropped 700 points in one day, Christie's auctioned off $30 million worth of jewelry and precious stones. When the Great Depression struck and farmers began losing their land, auctioneers thrived, but they acquired a reputation as last resort vultures which lingered for decades. Jones soon left full-time liquidation behind and began auctioning high-dollar real estate, ranches, and commercial properties worth millions of dollars. By the early 2000s, people didn't need a mediator to help them buy their collectible dolls and their vintage chairs. They wanted something like that. They could get it on eBay. The digital disruptors had shifted the world to a marketplace without the middleman. By building his business around real estate and industrial properties, Jones was better inoculated than others against the shifts in the industry. 2012, he was inducted into the National Auctioneers Association Hall of Fame, introduced as a balding dynamo from Dallas. I've listened to Jones' own chant several times. In 1998, it won the International Auctioneer Championship. Best I can tell, it begins, $5 now, 5, get a bid, $5 now, 10, get a bid, 10, 10 now, 15, dig a bigot, now 15, get a bid, now 20. He varies his hum around a low F key, breaking in with updates like, you're out here, and acknowledgments like, thank you, sir. The chant strikes the perfect balance between soothing and invigorating, like mall music. Standing before the class now, he launched into a short example. I'm at $50, now 75. Will you take it at 75, he started. Watching an authority chant up close was hardly demystifying. Jones held the microphone with his right hand. He used his left to both acknowledge bids and query potential bidders in the audience. Fingers together, palm facing up, reaching high to direct his attention to the back of the room, extending low to indicate a bidder in the front of the room. He was a performer and a conductor at the same time, scanning the crowd for any hint of interest and responding with an inquiring expression. Physically, he exuded calm, steady authority. You have to sound melodic, but you don't have to do a lot. If you roll it out right, it sounds like you're doing a lot of work, but you're not really, he said. He stressed that the chant needed to fit the situation. If you're doing a charity auction and you go too fast, you'll lose your crowd. In real estate, you'll scare them to death. In the front row, a thin young man named Cotter Bell raised his hand. Mr. Mike, I have a question, he said. Like, I listen to a lot of John Corey, and he says he uses his tongue a bunch, and that's what makes his numbers pop. Is that because he does cattle? Jones nodded. Yes, that's why. John is a cattle auctioneer out of Colorado, he told the rest of us. If you're sitting in an auction block all day peddling numbers, you're going to master that rhythm. It's coming off your tongue. If you want to be a cattle auctioneer, there are only one or two everyone wants to be like. Who do they sound like? John, Bell answered. John and who else, Jones said. Ralph Wade, Bell said. Who is Ralph Wade? Jones grew enthusiastic, as if he were about to lead the group in a testimonial. Dismounting from his tall chair, Jones walked to the side of the room and retrieved from a side table a 25-inch tall doll dressed in jeans, a shiny belt buckle, a tuxedo shirt, a jacket, and a black cowboy hat. The doll's mouth showed its lower teeth, frozen eternally, mid-chant. Jones held the doll by the rod against its back. This is Ralph Wade, he said, unable to hide his admiration from Luciano Pavarotti of his field. We had him stuffed. Ralph has his own damn doll. Jones pushed the belt buckle, triggering in the doll a barely decipherable chant. For 27 seconds, we all leaned in, grown adults, listening to a doll for all the wisdom it could impart. That morning, like we did every day, we warmed up with tongue twisters and number drills, our forearms outstretched like a droning choir of capitalists. You need to have hands out, asking for money, Jones said on the first day. That's your number one job. No lazy arms. Put your hands out. We needed to appear natural, moving one hand out in the direction of a possible bidder, Where is the bidder? What's your current bid? What's the bid you want after that and the one after that? Where are your hands? How's your rhythm? Are you projecting from the diaphragm? Is your chant melodic? Quit swaying from side to side and smile. Keeping track of our mouths, the movements, and the increasing numbers was more stressful than I'd imagined it would be. It was like rubbing your stomach and patting your head and reciting the alphabet backwards to a beat. Though the room was freezing, I was sweating. I could use a beer, I thought. It was 10 a.m. That afternoon, our solo bid call practice commenced. One by one, we performed in front of the class. To start us off, Jones selected Dawson Cowan, a 19-year-old butcher from San Angelo. Cowan was buff with shoulder-length Nordic blonde hair. He'd been attending various trade classes to round out his interests. Barrier school, concrete tank pouring school, gunsmithing school, and now this. I'd like to do this so I don't have to work for anyone else, he told the class when he introduced himself earlier that day. Now he stood before us, twitchy and unsure of what was expected of him. Hands up, Jones said. Cowan held his forearms at a 45-degree angle from his body and spotted an item on his table that he could pretend to auction off. I'm going to be selling a leather notebook, hand-inscribed, he started, opening the bid at $20. Someone offered him $5. $5, can I get 10? Jones interrupted him. It's going to be painful, Jones explained. You're going to have to get can out of your chant. Can creates doubt. Can I get? I don't know. Can you? How about will you get, or how about? He asked Cowan to place his hands behind his back to avoid waving around. Let's go, Jones said. Start over. Cowan sighed. With his arms still behind his back, he looked like a firing squad victim. He started back up, stumbling intermittently and accidentally eliminating crucial basic chant words like now. $20, can I get? Will you give me $20? I got $20, will you give me $30? Remember the basic chant, Jones asked. Cowan allowed a frustrated smile. At the moment, no, he said. Unsurprisingly, no one was eager to follow him. To keep the sequence moving, Lori Jones summoned each consecutive student with a tap on the shoulder. Lorraine Bice, with her drawl, struggled with her bid's increments. John Montgomery, with the big voice, stepped up. Montgomery already conducted charity auctions for his local business associations. I'd do it poorly, he told us. I'd like to do it better. He pointed his fingers at his audience like he was shooting them. Many students had difficulty with rhythm, and I had a hard time with all of it. I swayed. I couldn't project. I stiffened my hands like a toy soldier, and I concentrated so hard on keeping track of my increments that I sounded unnecessarily somber, like I was delivering bad news from the number world. We all stumbled over our chant. At some point, Jones placed a whiteboard with, "Will you give me?" directly in front of us as a reminder. But even with that assistance, we were floundering. That is, until Tyler Bell stepped out front. Bell, a high school senior from Anderson near College Station, had close-cropped hair and a country boy's polite ways with his sirs and ma'ams. He'd introduced himself earlier by saying, "My name is Tyler Bell, and I have a mom and dad and a sister." He said he'd always wanted to be an auctioneer because he liked the nature of it, the spirit of it. He was so shy he barely glanced at us for the first few seconds. We all looked on supportively. Then he started with a confident nasal hum. "All right, ladies and gentlemen." He immediately roused curiosity. Who was this and where had he come from? His chant was transformative. Imagine your most timid relative standing up at Thanksgiving and commandeering the table with Lizzo swagger, busting out, "'Cause I love you." He had luster. He had control. His performance was as daunting as it was inspiring. He'd been doing hometown auctions for a few years and had been to a junior competition, we later learned, but he showed more than experience. We were completely in his thrall. While the rest of us were struggling through our chants, Bell had already mastered that unteachable thing that all the best auctioneers have, total conviction. Over the coming days, we settled into a routine. At 8 o'clock each morning, we started with our drills. Next, Jones would usually ask us to open our giant red binders to a new chapter, and we'd hear a lecture from Jones or a guest auctioneer sharing his or her expertise. At some point, we'd each step up to the front of the room to sell one or two items and be critiqued by Jones and the class. Then we'd break for lunch. In the afternoon, we'd do it all over again, on good days selling a little better than the one before. Flailing our arms and jumbling our increments, we all discovered our individual chant handicaps. Do not get discouraged. Jones told 26-year-old Blaze Simonson, who seemed to have many difficulties. Each time Simonson finished his practice, he just smiled and shook his head. "Right about the time you're about to kill yourself, you're going to get it," Jones told him. "I was unable to easily count past 100 anymore, which was unsettling. I also had another more profound concern. I was worried that my voice was too high-pitched. I can sing, climb every mountain in a round, deep tone, torturing my children with a wall of volume. But I have a very hard time projecting my speaking voice without sounding screechy. Some women would call my self-consciousness about my high voice a function of the patriarchy, but I disagree. In auctioneering, high and loud voices are as irritating as low and loud voices are mesmerizing." On the third day, Jones brought in a champion named Sherry Boots Sutton. One of the most successful women in the male-dominated industry, Boots Sutton had a raspy voice and a steel spine. She had won the 2012 World Automobile Auctioneer Championship and the 1999 International Auctioneer Championship Women's Division. Women used to be an anomaly in the auction business, but their numbers have grown. Our own class was about 30% women. Boots Sutton had offered to coach us individually in an adjacent conference room. When it was my turn, I asked her if she had any advice for my voice. "Women can't make it unless you can adjust your voice," she said. "I used to be able to sing soprano, but I don't touch those notes now. I can't. I've trained my voice to be so low because you have to be aggressive, especially in the auto industry. If you're a passive auctioneer as a woman, you might as well not even try. It's going to eat you alive." After my meeting with Boots Sutton, I practiced my drills back in my hotel room. My voice cracked at key intervals, and deepening it made it sound comically artificial. Plus, it hurt. It felt like a small peach was lodged deep in my windpipe. Halfway through the course and barreling toward graduation, we had become exhausted by our chants, but we were stopping less often to groan and sigh deeply. I'd begun to turn my focus to bitters, and we were all feeling more comfortable. Bell no longer suppressed his swagger. At lunch one day, he told the waitress proudly, "Baby, I'm an auctioneer." By the afternoon of the fifth day, Jones declared us ready to go out into the world. A few students volunteered to drive, and we pulled into their cars for a field trip to a used auto auction house. After winding our way into an adjacent Dallas suburb by a caravan, we regrouped in the lobby of a warehouse-type building. We slapped on visitor badges, then walked into a long, cavernous, exhaust-filled room outfitted with garage doors to the right and left. The auction was already in full swing, and we stepped into a cacophony of bid calls. We hovered near the door, surveying the situation. The space was laid out like a vast bowling alley. There were 11 lanes, and an auction was being held in each one. An auction employee drove a car into the facility from the right-hand side, where interested parties would survey the car in motion. When the vehicle parked at the auction block at the left-side garage door, a brief auction would begin. For the past 15 years, car auctions had been a booming sector of auctioneering. By the 70s, Sotheby's and Christie's had come to New York and opened auction houses, a longtime auctioneer named Mike Brandley told me. In the 1980s, we started to see collector car auctions develop. The 1990s, oh man, we were rocking and rolling. Since the start of this golden age, car auctions have drawn followers and become a hugely profitable business. And it's not just the collectible cars. Average cars and even clunkers have valued it someone. While in Texas, the term auctioneer might call to mind a livestock auctioneer in a cowboy hat, car auctions bring bigger money. The room buzzed like a stock exchange floor, with each auctioneer selling a car literally every 20 seconds. "Watch your step," Jones told us. A driver easing down a lane would not be watching out for tourists. This was a place for professional auctioneers and professional bidders, car dealers mostly, who worked like dance partners. Some of the dealers bid with a head movement, others with a wave. I saw one guy bid by raising his eyebrows. When I turned my head toward the auctioneer, he instantly noticed my gaze, responded with an expression that asked, "Are you interested?" In another lane, I unthinkingly pointed toward a TV monitor and almost bought a Ford F-150 for $50,000. Here, dealers could size up the competition and buy their merchandise efficiently without even taking their hands out of their pockets. "Coolest thing I've ever seen in my life," Bell would say later. Take a little break here real quick and remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Radio. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and the Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and the Sound Radio since 1967. Now, back to our text. The average auctioneer makes $50,000 a year, but the best auctioneers make six figures. Just like in real estate, everyone is chasing the biggest sales. Every auctioneer wants to sell higher-priced items like fancy cars and yachts. Beyond the payout, selling high-priced goods is just more exciting. We saw how the rapidly escalating prices created a sense of urgency in even these seasoned bidders. People often pay more at live and online auctions than they would in a more straightforward transaction. They suffer from afflictions like the winner's curse, when auction winners pay either more than they plan to or more than the item's worth, and bidder's heat, a frenzied mindset as old as ancient Rome. It's called calor licitantis. We're helpless against the primal pull of competition. While buyers may come to an auction looking for a bargain, a funny thing happens after they take their seats. You need to know this as an auctioneer, Jones said. The minute a lot of buyers place a bid on an item, they're desperate to keep it. They become territorial. They're thinking, I'm not letting someone else get it. And someone outbids them on it. How dare you? The increments also have a huge effect on competition. Starting low gives the crowd the impression of a deal, which sticks in their minds even as the bids begin to soar. Then, once the auction gets rolling, the increments usually increase. If an auctioneer is raising the bid in $10 upticks and a bidder shouts out a $20 raise, bids generally keep going up at that rate. That causes other bidders to think, hey, this Garfield mug is hot. They become even more motivated. Auctioneers and their assistants, called ring men, must keep track of the most interested parties. They physically lean toward those bidders to gauge their interest, flattering them with attention. They call the regulars by name and play the bidders off one another. Since the dealers at the car auction were buying inventory, they weren't behaving as emotionally as someone might at a weekend estate auction or a charity auction. They didn't tend to indulge themselves beyond their budgets, but they were keeping an eye on one another just in case a bidder known for sharp buys knew something the others didn't about the car's condition or value. We could see it happening around us. Bids might come along steadily, then one knowledgeable dealer would bid and the other dealers would perk up, causing a frenzy for a few seconds before the price reached a tipping point and all but the winner kicked the ground and walked away. At an auction, actual worth falls away. Worth is dependent upon bidders' momentary whims, various unique personal equations that neutralize the outside world's opinions as well as the seller's sentimentality. The bidder, I saw, was like a spectator at a magic show. Audience members walk in with a skeptical mind, but they secretly crave a portal into another dimension where anything is possible, where financial realities are suspended in the face of tantalizing urgency. Whether that old poster is really worth the $1,000 you paid for it is almost irrelevant. You won. By the evening of the live-streamed charity auction, most of us had settled on some version of a chant. Lorraine Bice announced that she was fine with being slow. Tyler Bell had only gotten more confident. Some students, like Blaze Simonson, would deploy the chants they'd been using for years with only modest alterations. After struggling in chant practice sessions, Simonson had revealed himself to be the Susan Boyle of our class during an after-hours session with a guest lecturer, chanting confidently. When I cornered him in the classroom, he aw-shucked his way through an explanation. He'd been auctioning livestock for about 2 years, and his obstacle during class had less to do with chants generally than with adjusting to Jones's basic chant. I, for one, planned to stick with the easy chant, nothing fancy. I'd mastered the will you give me filler, the rhythm, and the pace, and still struggling to keep track of my numbers, but I was in good shape. Dawson Cowan offered me a single critique. The only thing I can really say to you about improvement is just loudness. We gathered in the lobby restaurant in our best attire. Those whose formal wear included cowboy hats wore cowboy hats. Those whose included heels wore heels. Leaning against high-top cocktail tables, classmates gave one another pep talks before entering the conference room, where a few friends and family bidders and the online audience would watch us conduct an auction. For most of us, it would be our first involving actual money. I think it will be an experience, my classmate, David Skidmore, told me. We have to get used to standing in front of people and talking. We have to control our breathing. I think that's the main thing. Control your breathing and smile. identifying the bidders and then knowing what number you're at. I wasn't very confident yet I could do any of those things independently or together when I bumped into Cowan. I mentioned that I could hear him down the hallway practicing as I was walking to the elevator. "Did you hear me mess up too?" he asked. The pressure was on Cowan now, as his mom had advertised the class auction on her Facebook page and secured his first job. The lady who does my mom's nails is big into charity auctions, and she's got one lined up for me already, he said. "He's already on the move," Lorraine Bice said. Inside the conference room, Jones wore a Stars and Stripes necktie and situated himself in front of the camera, flanked by a Texas flag and an American flag. "Let's kick it off," he said. "You want to hear a cool song?" Signaling to Lori Jones, he cued the Leroy Van Dyke 1956 country hit "The Auctioneer," tapping his finger against the microphone to the beat. The song narrated the tale of a boy in Arkansas who wouldn't listen to his ma and skipped school to watch auctioneers at the local auction barn. The song is 3 minutes long. About 1 minute in, I thought Jones would fade it out. He didn't. He played the whole song, looking placidly around at the class, bouncing their knees and nodding their heads. A few of the students mouthed the rapid-fire lyrics. We were off. Bice introduced herself. "I may not be the fastest person tonight, but I am the happiest. Sold a box of goodies and gift certificates from her hometown." Skidmore presented a camouflage golf bag, putting on the hard sell. "If you're a hunter, you might be able to stick some guns in there." John Montgomery, testing the decibel levels of the speaker system, sold custom knives. Cowan sold a San Angelo gift basket, encouraging bidders with eyebrows up, free hand out. Bell expertly sold a pair of size 10 boot pad inserts with a confident purr, throwing in one more time for fun to bring the bids up to $50. Simonson sold a skinning knife, starting out, "Looky there now, good knife there now, how much here now?" Before launching into a beautiful droning chant, he reached out toward the audience, to the left, to the right, with such absorbed concentration that he didn't notice Jones holding the knife nearby, continually having to dodge Simonson's arm to avoid slicing it open. Then it was my turn. I started by selling two Texas Monthly Barbecue Club subscriptions for $80 apiece, and then I sold an old Auction Academy computer bag for $60. It was thrilling and nerve-wracking, but besides pointing with my index finger, insulting, and rocking back and forth like a hockey goalie, distracting, I held my own. With a microphone in my hand, I didn't worry about volume. My voice thrummed along just a few notes lower than what felt natural. Afterward, as I left the stage, Jones commended me for applying myself. I was finally starting to understand what our guest lecturers meant when they said the numbers come naturally. 6 days in, I could get the crowd almost three-quarters of my attention. Over the remaining days, we would learn about livestock and ethics. We would take a written test, which nearly everybody would pass. We would pose with Jones as we received our diplomas. Bice would head back to her antique shop in Jefferson. Cowan would prepare for his first big auction back home. Bell would return to Anderson, where he'd graduate from high school and win the Oklahoma Junior Big Calling Contest. One last ride, he said, before moving into cattle auctions. But on the night of the charity auction, as Lori Jones announced our grand total of $8,159 for the charities, I scanned the room's tables, stacked with gift baskets and neckties and religious books and socks. And that was when I realized we could sell damn near anything. Texas Monthly asks, observers were quick to compare the recent protest to the racial unrest we saw across the country in 1968. Should people who are trying to understand what's going on now look first to 1968 or to 2014, when the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner set off a new wave of protests? Mr. Joseph says, I think 1968 is a turning point after the urban uprisings in 125 cities in the aftermath of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. The rhetoric of law and order won the day. Social justice activists, including King, had argued that urban revolts were a response to white supremacy and structural racism. But there was no political will to make massive investments in racially segregated, economically impoverished, and brutally policed communities. After 1968, we get instead 52 straight years of a criminal justice system that is designed to police and profile and incarcerate, and at times kill and brutalize as many African Americans as possible. 1968, the Safe Streets Omnibus Bill, passed by Congress and signed by Lyndon Johnson, puts the federal government in the business of giving out what's going to be billions of dollars for criminal justice in the form of grants, and puts the federal government in the anti-crime business and out of the anti-poverty business. We made thousands of poverty policy choices that continued to criminalize African Americans and continued to invest in large police forces, both when crime was up and when crime was going down. We went from a prison system that had 300,000 people in 1970 to 2.3 million today, and more than 4 million people on parole and probation. Texas Monthly says, what do you make of the fact that Joe Biden, the presumed Democratic nominee for president, was intimately involved for decades in building up that system of incarceration? Mr. Peniel says, for decades, there has been bipartisan support for not just mass incarceration and prison building, but the criminalization of black neighborhoods and disinvestment from those neighborhoods. Of course, Biden was a part of that. Ronald Reagan was part of it. There are even some African-American politicians who voted for tough-on-crime bills. This is a national problem. Texas Monthly says, quite a few people in power have urged protesters to emulate the model set down by Dr. King. Are they right to? Mr. Joseph says, they're misusing King. King was not violent. The King was a political revolutionary. King was talking about radical social democratic activism. He wanted a universal basic income before Andrew Yang and the Johnny Come Latelys did. He wanted health care and food justice and environmental justice. He wanted an end to police brutality and tried to negotiate with big city police chiefs in Los Angeles and New York to make that happen. He failed. He linked the war in Vietnam to the lack of investment in urban neighborhoods. King was saying that militarism, materialism, and racism were the triple evils facing humanity. When people asked him about rioting and looting, he said we needed to look at the origin of the problem and that rioting was the language of the oppressed and the unheard and those who had been marginalized. Texas Monthly's next question, the civil rights movement in the 60s seems to have been quite organized. Lots of groups with acronyms and identifiable leaders. The activists pushing for Black Lives Matter seem more decentralized. Neil Joseph says, what Black Lives Matter has done is combine the nonviolent civil disobedience of the civil rights movement with the structural critique of white supremacy and racism of the Black Power movement. They've been very, very effective. They looked at how public policy was impacting what district attorneys could and could not do. They looked at things like pretrial diversion, how you could end the cash and the money bail system, how you could vote district attorneys out of office. They went to the very granular level of, hey, here are the forces that are controlling our lives, and we need to organize and mobilize people in the streets, resist killer cops. But they've also asked how we can reimagine small d democracy in a way that's going to invest in our communities instead of incarcerating and criminalizing us. Texas Monthly asked, are you concerned about a political backlash to the protests? Mr. Joseph says, I'm not that worried. I think right now we have a generational opportunity to eradicate institutional racism and defeat white supremacy, to build what King called a beloved community that is free of racial injustice, that is multiracial, multicultural, and interested in equity and radical citizenship and dignity for all people. Of course, people will spin this and talk about violence and looting and backlash, but people are spinning that only to keep their own base and their own constituency. We're the most partisan that we've been since right before the Civil War. Anybody who's intelligent and who lives in the United States can feel it. You either think that the murder of George Floyd means that we have to do a wholesale reimagining of who we are as Americans, or you think that we have to double down on law and order and have an even bigger criminal justice state. Those are very, very stark divisions. From that perspective, I don't have much fear about a backlash because neither side is really listening to the other. I don't think that's great. I think that's one of the reasons why we're a democracy in decline. But those who are interested in spreading false narratives and smears, they're only going to be talking to themselves because we are that divided. Texas Monthly's last question. Texas has been at the forefront of criminal justice reform efforts. What do you think of the prospects for further change here? Peniel Joseph says, all politics are local, and I think that criminal justice reform and the push for social change will continue to gain momentum at the local level. Cities such as Austin, San Antonio, Dallas, and Houston will be under enormous pressure to fundamentally transform their approach to policing and racial and public school segregation and to make investments in health care, education, mental health, housing affordability, transportation, and the environment. The protests that have spread throughout Texas cities are truly remarkable. They represent a generational opportunity to end institutional racism and defeat white supremacy. This interview has been edited for clarity and length. And a couple more items here from What Lies Ahead, the future-looking section. It was the cover story and main feature article of this month's issue for July. This one is entitled Future Doctor Visits, the Unexpected Intimacy of Telemedicine. On a Friday afternoon last summer, a patient, Barb, texted me, "Call me, I can't breathe." As a heart failure nurse serving rural patients, getting messages like Barb's launches my adrenaline. I called her immediately. A month earlier, I trained Barb to send daily vital signs via my clinic's digital portal. The previous week, her weight had trended upward. We'd already discussed minimizing her beverage and sodium intake. Barb was suffering from congestive heart failure exacerbation. Her lungs were filling with fluid. We didn't remove it. She'd need to be hospitalized, or worse. Once I was sure she wasn't in emergency distress, I called the clinic's cardiologist for instructions. Then I phoned Barb's pharmacy and ordered a new diuretic to add to her regimen. A water pill so powerful in its fluid offloading effect that I've nicknamed it the Bellagio. Within 2 hours, Barb had taken the pill and begun to urinate out the fluid, flooding her lungs. By the next morning, she was breathing comfortably. Well, without access to a telehealth program, Barb would probably have gone to the emergency room, then to the intensive care unit for the expensive intravenous medications. Once she was sent home, the hospital would have charged her insurance company thousands of dollars for her short stay and the ambulance ride. Instead, Barb recovered after a single dose of the Bellagio, which at local Walgreens cost about $2 a tablet. Our cardiology clinic carries out monthly check-ins as part of our chronic care management phone program, and we offer daily check-ins for patients who have advanced heart failure. We've seen how monthly phone contact allows nurses to catch medication errors and symptoms that patients might otherwise ignore. But it wasn't until the pandemic when we began leaning more heavily on telehealth options that I really began to appreciate the connective value of remote medicine. Doctors' offices can be anxiety-inducing. We surround patients with uniformed staff and strange equipment that appraises your health for better or worse. For many, even stepping onto the scale can feel like a character judgment. But once patient and provider were on lockdown, separated from those intimidating surroundings, the division between us dissolved. When we were both at home, sometimes still in our pajamas, our dogs barking, our oven timer dinging, doctor visits became less intimidating, even comforting. Since March, a cardiologist has remarked multiple times that patients seem more comfortable speaking to him over the phone than they would if they were sitting in the fluorescent light of an exam room. The doctor-patient rapport has begun to mimic the camaraderie and intimacy that I share with my patients as a nurse. One day, we may welcome patients back for in-person visits, but for now, we value how distance medicine can strengthen connections. That was by Susan Ullman. And this next section, still from the What Lies Ahead feature article. This is entitled A Future Exercise. Living Room Aerobics is the New Fitness Craze. This is by Lauren Larson. By day, Michael Frazier is a florist. By later in the day, he is an aerobic demon. I was only halfway through the online dance cardio routine he choreographed to Britney Spears' Hold It Against Me when I aborted a body roll and wilted against my couch. The video's runtime was a little under 25 minutes, but it took me an hour to finish because I kept rewinding and pausing to stretch. It was early May, mid-pandemic. Frazier typically teaches packed classes at Caulfield's Dance Fitness, a Dallas studio run by former Mavericks dancer Kristen Caulfield. When the pandemic arrived, studio turned to Instagram Live and YouTube. I'd sampled digital classes from a few instructors while hunkered down in my apartment, but I quickly imprinted on Frazier because of his reverence for Spears' oeuvre. This sprightly, bleached, blonde man would shepherd me through the dark weeks ahead. A home fitness regimen was not ideal. My neighbor and I were already embroiled in a passive-aggressive noise standoff. At one point, I put a little too much feeling into a serpentine arm motion, punching a picture frame in my tiny living room. Plus, dance cardio is not an activity one usually does alone. When I spoke to Frazier later by phone, he said that while he appreciated that he's been able to continue teaching classes, he missed the energy of a steamy, crowded studio. Dancing in an empty room exhausted him. The lack of energy bummed me out too, but it felt like a decent trade-off for the reduced price of classes. The low cost of online offerings, of course, has been crippling for gyms and boutique studios. During the shutdown, classes from Caulfield's were donation-based. When I spoke to Kristen Caulfield in April, she told me that although many clients chipped in anywhere from $5 to $100, she needed to reopen soon to stay afloat. Caulfield's has since resumed some in-person classes. But after months of working out for cheap and the forgiving privacy of our homes, will we actually return to communal fitness? That question is a pressing one, even for well-established fitness titans like Dallas-based Gold's Gym. The first Gold's Gym opened its doors in Venice Beach, California in 1965 as a space for muscleheads to convene, spawning the bodybuilding movement and popularizing its communities. Gold's now has company-owned and franchised locations in 29 countries. On March 16th, Gold's temporarily closed all company-owned U.S. locations. Then in April, it permanently shut down both Dallas locations. In May, the company filed for bankruptcy protection and began touting digital alternatives. CEO Adam Zaitsev had been fretting about people like me, those who craved the convenience of at-home options long before the pandemic. 3 years ago, Gold's rolled out an app called AMP, in which members and non-members for $9.95 a month could follow music-driven workouts. In 2017, we saw this coming. Not the pandemic, of course. We saw a need for virtual fitness coming, Zaitsev said. We certainly didn't feel we were going to be Blockbuster to Netflix, if you will, but we knew there'd be some disruption. During the pandemic, AMP amped up. Gold created 140 new on-demand workouts and temporarily offered the app free to non-members. Zaitsev deemed it the right decision for humanity. Ultimately, the fitness industry needs bodies and rooms to remain viable. This means gym-goers must feel safe enough to maintain their memberships. And while some gym zealots have argued that fitness facilities are essential, fitness appears to reduce the risk of complications from COVID-19, many pointed out that gyms were potential cesspools for transmission. A CDC report described a February incident in which 112 people in South Korea contracted COVID-19 from dance fitness instructors. Zaitsev says Gold's was requiring members to sign an updated code of conduct agreeing to follow social distancing best practices, and employees were being trained to enforce those rules. His expectation, informed by surveys, is that once people feel comfortable, they will rush to the gym to rehone atrophied muscles. I think September could be a mini January, he said, referring to the post-holiday renewal of fitness vows. He hopes customers will find a balance between digital and in-person fitness, explaining that the convenience of an at-home workout is always going to appeal to some people. I think the hybrid approach has kind of accelerated as a result of this pandemic, he said, but he added, he doesn't see that acceleration as a harbinger of the end of gyms. There are plenty of things that you just can't replace in the gym. Relative vastness, for one thing. Besides punching a picture frame, I've also kickboxed my phone off a chair, not to mention the expensive equipment. And then there's the sense of community. The gym's great trump card over virtual fitness, sharing hashtag gains on Instagram, we'll never approximate the adrenaline one gets from a room full of potential mates and rivals glistening and slamming weights. Sigh. But recently, community has begun to seem, at best, foreign, and at worst, repellent. When that discomfort does finally pass, there will be fewer gyms to return to. And it is so hot, y'all. I got to read this one again. This is Food and Drink, Three of a Kind, Jessica Dupree, Summertime Booze. Some of the state's best bartenders share how to make their favorite chilled aperitifs. The Pegu Club with Bill Norris. He's known as Austin's father of modern cocktails. Norris has been slinging clever concoctions for nearly two decades. As the beverage director for Alamo Draft House's 40-plus locations, he also developed numerous bar concepts, including downtown's Midnight Cowboy. This summer, he's pouring one out at home for New York City's Pegu Club, a cocktail mecca that recently shuttered its door permanently in the wake of the pandemic. Pegu Club's reach and importance can't be overstated, he says. To make its eponymous drink in a shaker with ice, combine 2 ounces of London Dry style gin, 3/4 of an ounce of orange curacao, 3/4 of an ounce of fresh lime juice, and 1 dash each of Angostura and orange bitters. Shake hard for at least 10 seconds, strain into a chilled coupe, and garnish with a slice of lime. Then we got the 50-50 Freezer Martini from Houston Eves at San Antonio's Esquire Tavern. Beverage director Eves says the government stay-at-home orders let him appreciate the simplicity of the perfect martini. When you've been in the same hoodie for a month, you could certainly use some civility, he says. For a martini whenever you want, empty one 750-milliliter bottle each of Navy-strength gin and dry vermouth into a large pitcher. Stir briefly and then refill the two bottles and place them in the freezer for at least a few hours. Pour into a chilled martini glass. Express a lemon peel over the drink. Add a few olives. Summertime Smash from Megan McClinton. She's a bartender at Proper, one of Fort Worth's swankiest neighborhood bars. McClinton offers up a seasonal nod to the classic whiskey smash in a rocks glass, model 5 berries of any kind, and 3/4 of an ounce of honey syrup, a 1-to-1 ratio of honey and water dissolved over low heat. Add 3/4 of an ounce of lemon juice and 1 3/4 ounces of bourbon. Cover with crushed ice and stir slightly. Enjoy your back patio, porch, or balcony, Clinton says. And I think we'll run out of stuff to do in this one. We might come back to some more things in this edition because we have some more stories, but I think next show we're going to get after our August issue. It should be along shortly. And with that, it brings us to the end of our reading today. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30. The energy sector is experiencing a historic shock because of the combination of lower demand due to the coronavirus and an escalation in production from Saudi Arabia and Russia. In these uncertain times, we invite you to join us for the weekly Business and Oil Report. Recording Library volunteers and staff read the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American Business and Oil pages.
Rig count plunges by 23 in Permian Basin.
Super majors prefer independents go bankrupt.
Local car dealers survives through downturn.
Here is the regular column by Dennis Ellen.
Permian Basin Better Business Bureau.
Parsley Pioneer ask RRC for market demand hearing.
The Economist by M. Ray Perryman.
Pioneer CEO Scott Sheffield. We really need Trump to do something or he's going to lose all the energy states in this election.
The Business and Oil Report. Friday mornings at 6 and repeated Sunday nights at 7 and Thursdays at 4 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Said goodbye. There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. I think it's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street, singing songs and carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 98 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 80s. Then tomorrow, clear with a high around 102. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the August issue of Texas Highways, and since it's the first of the month, I'll start out with the editor's note, and it's by Emily Roberts Stone. Y'all means all. A few months ago, our staff received an email from a reader seeking travel advice. A common occurrence for us. A recently retired teacher, she wanted to start dreaming up future trips to take once the state reopened, to see places she'd never been, learn more about the state's rich heritage, and support local businesses anxious for customers. But her note came with a deep concern. I'm really afraid because of the racism I've faced as a black woman in the state. Is it possible for you to publish a guide detailing where people like me can travel in Texas and feel safe, valued, and welcomed? From 1936 to 1964, the National Park Service oversaw the Route 66 Green Book Project, an annual travel guide providing black travelers with options for lodging and dining and other information on safely traveling during the era of segregation. In 2020, a guide like that seems antiquated and unnecessary, or at least we want it to be. But the truth is, I've received emails from more than a few black readers over the last couple of years, talking about places they visited where they felt unsafe or unwelcome. Their experiences run counter to Texas's reputation for hospitality. There are also encouraging stories of Texas towns that are passionate about ensuring that everyone who visits has an enjoyable and enlightening experience. In Palestine, Local tourism leaders continue to focus efforts on highlighting the history of the many cultures that make up East Texas. We have a diverse city, and we want to make sure we're reflecting the community as a whole, explains Mary Rahm, who grew up in Palestine and leads the city's tourism marketing efforts. In the last 15 years, the town has become increasingly diverse, with nearly an equal percentage of white, black, and Hispanic residents. 4 months ago, the city hired a heritage development coordinator to work on various tourism projects and provide an unbiased perspective on the history of Palestine and its residents. Tourism leaders are working with former resident Reggie Brown on refreshing and digitizing a 1997 guide on local black historic sites. Brown, whose father was the second African-American county commissioner in Texas, has also helped establish 9 historical markers in Palestine, along with 28 more throughout the state. My experience has been very inclusive in dealing with the city of Palestine, Brown says. I have felt very welcomed. Similar efforts are underway across Texas, and we'll continue to highlight them in our pages and on TexasHighways.com. Our mission has always been to encourage travel within the state, and implicit in that mission is the ability for everyone to travel safely. Every Texan should have the freedom to explore and discover the great beauty and distinctive character of our state's natural treasures, historic sites, and small towns. And now our next article, We All Live in Uncertain. The Handshake is Alive and Well in This East Texas Town, by Sarah Heppola. Think of Caddo as a maze of lakes within lakes, says John Wynn, proprietor of Caddo Outlet Outback Tours, as the two of us settle into a small go-devil boat roped to a dock in Uncertain, on the border of northern Louisiana. For 2 decades, Wynn has given tours of this lake, named for the Caddo tribe who settled in the area in the late 18th century. And he's had to retrieve a number of people lost in the labyrinth of bayous, ponds, and narrow channels. Boy, are they glad to see me, he says, tugging his gray beard. I ask what could get them. Nothing, he says. But floating in the unknown spooks a person. Around 60 species of reptiles live in the swamp, and the night grows noisy with the screech and swish. Gators lurk in these waters. They won't attack, but when the light of the boat shines on them, their marble eyes turn red, like taillights rising from the swamp. The name is what drew me to Uncertain. It sounds like a thick novel or one of those creepy noir films from the Coen brothers, but in the months since COVID-19 began dismantling the life we once knew, it has become a global condition. What will become of us? Who should we be? We are all living in Uncertain now. Of course, the 2018 census placed the town's population a bit lower, at 59. It was a few days before Memorial Day, as Texas continued to creak open its doors after weeks of sheltering in place, and I was looking to escape, but not flee caution. I'd visited Uncertain years ago, and I fell in love with a landscape that was peaceful and otherworldly, with many purported Bigfoot sightings in the area. I remember how I walked under the canopy of tall, thin cypress trees, gesturing as I told them my troubles. And while the trees were indifferent, they were also a bit kind. Spanish moss draping from the trees wafted in the breeze. In French Polynesia, they call Spanish moss Grandpa's beard. But to me, the stuff looked like Ophelia's hair, or the gauzy fabrics Stevie Nicks wore in her gypsy phase. The trees were witchy like that, haunted maidens who never give away their secrets. Nobody knows for certain how Uncertain got its name, which seems exactly right. On a late Thursday morning, I sling my beat-up green suitcase into the trunk of my car and head east from my home in Dallas. 2.5 hours along Interstate 20 and into the piney woods of East Texas. The next 30 minutes take me along state and farm roads where my cell signal starts to disappear. I'm heading into the kind of rural emptiness where you double-check the gas level and rearview mirror. I'm outdoorsy enough to find all of this achingly romantic, but my less generous city friends might call it serial killer country. Uncertain is not on the way to anywhere, says Sheriff Tom McCool of Harrison County in a 2017 documentary titled Uncertain. You've got to either know where you're going or be lost to find it. The evocative film is a portrait of men lost in a more existential way. Stream it on Amazon and Vimeo, though it barely scratches the surface of a town whose mysteries run deep. The fact that Netflix has not greenlighted a narrative series about Uncertain is evidence that even the golden age of television has blind spots, and that I should be hired by Netflix. Uncertain is one of those places where every passing stranger feels like a character. The tiny woman with white hair and bright eyes who shows up on the porch of my cabin, dangling a cigarette to collect money for my stay, cash preferred. The man with the mustache at the small grocery store buying a vial of pickle juice to pour into his beer, a new trend. The middle-aged couple outside a bar and grill called Lighthouse, engaging in a friendly debate about whether a shirt bought at a Guns N' Roses concert should be worn after the concert, or does it lose value? Inside the Lighthouse, it's the first day back in business after lockdown, and things are a bit weird. A handwritten sign outside the door lists rules that include no sitting at the bar and no switching tables. Dancing is discouraged, reads one, sounding more like the Bible Belt laws that inspired the classic 80s movie Footloose than the rules of a town that still allows smoking indoors. The wood-paneled, neon-lit bar is just starting to fill at 6 p.m., and the vibe is jokey but compliant. People squirt hand sanitizer into their palms as they enter. A woman sways near the jukebox, one arm outstretched like she's holding an imaginary partner. "This is my social distancing dance," she says. Rules are a tough fit for a part of the state accustomed to being left alone. Wynn told me in advance of my 90-minute boat tour that he only takes cash or check. "You know, they aren't taking cash in Dallas at all these days," I told him, and he chuckled, a smoker's laugh. "Isn't that something," he said. "The world's getting crazy." Out on Cattle Lake, Wynn revs the motor of his Go Devil, and we head into the maze, which at nearly 27,000 acres is one of the state's largest lakes. I have a mask in my backpack, but we sit so far apart that the precaution seems moot. "Most of the folks around here are seasonal," Wynn tells me as we pass holiday boaters and a woman kayaking with a toy dog in her lap. Wynn is part of the year-round crew. He grew up in Uncertain, born to a mother who left and a father who drank, a happy alcoholic, he says. He taught himself to fish and dropped out of school in 9th grade. "Caddo raised me," he says. "Caddo fed me." He is something of a swamp creature, a peculiar breed adapted to this remote spot that is not quite Cajun country and not quite Lone Star State, a land lost in time. He navigates the boat through a shallow channel, and we emerge into a part of the lake that is empty, gorgeous, eerily silent. For years, Caddo has been fighting the invasion of an aggressive giant salvinia plant, kept in check with herbicides and weevils, a joint effort of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, scientists, and rock star Don Henley, among others. The waterways are clear today, though it's impossible to know how long Mother Nature can be tamed. Wynn tells me he spent the past few months at home gardening with his wife. They own 9 acres about a mile from the lake. The only part of his job he never liked was the phone ringing constantly, but worse was the phone not ringing at all. A silent phone is scary for a small business owner, but with sanctions continuing to lift across the state, the phone is annoying him again. "People are champing at the bit," he tells me.